This is Junk Food Cinema. Get on that dance floor, junkies, because it's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmScoreRejects.com.
.com.
And you are about to have, I promise you, the time of your life.
Oh, God damn it. This is going to be a whole episode of this,
isn't it? I swear,
it's
the truth.
Oh, God, this is going to be a whole episode of this, dear Christ almighty.
What's this, Pandora's box? Yeah, why don't you just open it by having us talk about Dirty Dancing? Just crack that sucker right open.
Well, I mean, no Summer of 87 recap would be complete without one of the biggest, craziest hits of the fucking summer.
Spinning all the craziest hits on wax right here on FilmScoreRejects.com.
Dude, the movie, not only is it a good movie, not only is it a satisfying as hell movie, it's a weird movie, and it's one that deserves to be talked about in true junkie fashion.
Yes. Speaking of weird and satisfying, Junk Food Cinema, your weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good it just has to be fattening, where even our eyes are hungry. See, that one was yours. I'm quoting you, so you can't even throw me under the bus.
No, I was actually guessing you were going to make that comment. That was when I was working on the over-under of how many of these you had worked into this episode.
You can't give me a softball like that, because I will knock it out of
you
the
will
park.
You will take a swing at it, at
you
least
make that many puns, I'm gonna put you in the corner.
Oh, nobody puts punny in the corner. But so here we are, and it's time to introduce each other. We're way off track today.
Sorry about that, Stargrove. I am Brian Salisbury. I'm Brian Salisbury. He's C. Robert Cargill. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He is definitely going to be performing at the big talent show here in the Catskills. I'm looking forward to your rendition of whatever the hell that song is that the sister sings. It just mutilates it.
Hulahana. Pardon me. Hulahana. And which she wrote. That actress wrote that song.
And oh my God.
By the way, we are joined this week by a good friend of ours, Wendy Bowlesby, fresh off performing in the Minneapolis Fringe Festival.
That's right.
What did you do in the Fringe Festival? Because Brian has not heard this yet.
Well, I was an actor in a play, a comedic play, the comedic adaptation of the nonfiction book Death in Yosemite, an encyclopedia of all the different ways that people have died in Yosemite National Park, broken out by cause of death.
And so you guys performed reenactments of the craziest deaths in Yosemite, correct?
Tim couldn't even fit all the craziest ones in there. The problem being that some of them are just too long and involved to get all the way. You need to have Tim tell you about the drug plane. That one's a great story, but that would have taken up most of the play. No, I think my favorite is the guy who stood on the edge of a waterfall and pretended he wanted his friend to take his picture there. So he's like, oh, take this picture. I'm going to pretend that I'm falling over. And then he did.
And they got a picture of it.
Photography imitates art sometimes.
But anyhow, so
I don't know what's going on.
She's here with us because the minute I mentioned that we were covering this movie, she lost her shit, because you're probably a bigger fan of this than I am, and I'm a big fan of this movie.
This movie came out in 1987. I was 17. This movie is my movie. I was a 17-year-old female in high school, and there was Patrick Swayze, and it is
what I believe the ultimate female wish fulfillment movie. Like, it pushes every single button that a woman wants out of an entertaining film. Like, this is like the James Bond movie of women. Like, this is movie where it's like, here's everything that women want in a satisfying film, and we're gonna just smash all the buttons at once.
Yes, definitely. Yes, also everything that a theater geek female would want as
that
well.
Is also
who
true.
Is a, as a dancer. So. You know, one of my favorite movies is Xanadu, and I can't help but say
one of our favorite movies is Xanadu.
I can't help but mention all the connections to Xanadu, and I actually had a really shitty weekend in high school, and my mom rented this from the video store and brought it home with ice cream, and that turned into a better weekend.
Is that because the Catskills is also a place where nobody would dare to go? Is that the connection between these two movies? No? Okay, fair enough.
You were reaching for that one, buddy.
I was, as I do with most of the jokes on this show. Welcome, Wendy. I didn't realize this was your first time. So I also want to mention, since we mentioned James Bond, I'm going to jump on that segue and tell you that if you are a Patreon subscriber, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, we are doing, finally, The Spy Who Loved Me, Summer of 77, this week.
That we've been putting up for 6 weeks because of a crazy schedule.
Various things. So definitely, if you're not a subscriber, now would be a good time. And yes, as we mentioned, burying the lead, not so much because we opened with a lot of song lyrics. We're covering Dirty Dancing.
Best Strong Pictures presents Dirty Dancing. She thought it would be just another summer vacation.
Who's that?
Oh, them. They're the dance people.
But it turns out to be the time of her life.
Watch me now!
I can't even do the merengue.
He teaches her what she can do.
I'm not sure who you are, but I don't want you to have anything to do with those people again.
Baby, I don't see you running up to Daddy telling him I'm your guy.
Well, with my father, it's complicated. I will tell him.
I don't believe you, baby.
She shows him all he can be.
You gotta stop it now.
I know what I'm doing, Penny.
I'm scared of everything. Most of all, I'm scared of walking out of this room and never feeling the rest of my whole life the way I feel when I'm with you.
What they learn from each other feels too good to be wrong. Starring Patrick Swayze, Jennifer Grey, and Cynthia Rhodes. Get ready for the time of your life.
Which is great because it's the first romance that we've talked about, I think, in summer of 87 or 86.
And it is iconic. What I love is that this movie spawned so much that even now, how many years later? 30?
It's the 30th anniversary of everything.
Yeah, okay. I'm my mathing is off today. But so 30 years later, and I am at roller derby practice and with people who probably weren't even born when this movie came out. But you say spaghetti arms and everybody knows exactly what you're talking about.
Can I say that roller derby is probably, of all the sports, the one where I don't believe there is respected dancer space? Like, I don't feel that in roller derby it could be like, well, this is my roller space and that's your roller space.
However, spaghetti arms are very important when you are trying to brace your teammates so they can hit somebody else more effectively.
You want
a strong dance frame for that shit.
It's like roller Red Rover.
I don't like you sometimes.
Also, the thing I love about Derby in particular, before we Stargrove back into the actual movie.
Stargrove!
It is the one, badass sport where men are mocked for considering playing it. Because there is Derby, and then there's Dangle Derby.
Merby.
And Merby.
Some call it Merby.
Yeah, that's the nicer version. Dangle Derby is, I think, the better name.
Wasn't Merby the race of alien that Mac was in Mac and Me, or am I completely misremembering that movie?
I think you're mixing up Furby with Mac and Me.
That's what it is. You know what? That's what it is.
But, just in case any of my male roller derby friends are listening, you know I love you, but let's be honest, female roller derby is a lot more popular.
It's and it's a lot more badass.
Speaking of things that are popular with women, we mentioned him already, but as you may know, listening to this podcast, we are Swayze crazy up in this shit.
We do like the Swayze.
We are Sway Cray in a good way.
Well, and I was reading something that talked about how this was Patrick Swayze's breakout role, and what's interesting is that...
Sorry.
Everybody knew who Patrick Swayze was when he was in this by this point because of North and South and The Outsiders, at least bearing in mind I was a teenage girl.
But this was the one that, I mean, you knew who he was, but there's a lot of actors like that who, you know that actor, and then they have that role. It's like everybody knows who Kumail Nanjiani is. Like, they've seen him in a bunch of movies, but when you see The Big Sick, all of a sudden everybody's like, that guy's a star, that guy can open movies.
I call it a star turn. It's the movie that took somebody everybody knew.
That's what a breakout role is. It's not the first appearance of them. It's where
that's semantics.
Because after this point, then we have him attaching himself to a little thing called Tango
Cash
and a bunch of other movies, and then would end up getting us Roadhouse.
I think it's fascinating that his star quality was both as Macho Man, Roadhouse, and Steel Dawn, but also as incredibly tender romantic leads, such as in Ghost.
Red Dawn.
No.
Steel Dawn was his... What? Wasn't Steel Dawn his brother?
No, he was in both Red Dawn and Steel Dawn.
That's why it's called Steel Dawn.
Don't you Swayze explain to me, man.
Yeah. No. In fact, Steel Dawn is summer of 87, and we have not covered it because, oh boy, does it not hold up.
Oh, there's a lot to look at there, but there's not a lot
to
watch.
It's one of those that it was like, maybe if we have an extra week, we'll cover Steel Dawn because it's fun, but it's kind of like, there's a lot of dead spots in Steel Dawn.
I have to applaud the restraint that you have shown in the last minute and a half. We're talking about Swayze and the movies that put him on the map, and not once did the word Skate Town USA leave your mouth.
Because Skate Town USA is his true breakout.
Oh yeah.
In 1979, but you know, only certain people got to see it because it was supposedly never released on VHS.
Because people didn't accept male roller derby at the time, and that's why nobody saw Skate Town USA, I believe is the case. But if you're not familiar with Dirty Dancing, yes you are. You're lying. You're absolutely familiar with Dirty Dancing.
If you're not, then you need to watch it. This film is beautiful.
My wife had never seen it, and so
she got to have her first experience watching it.
Yes,
she
had a blast. Like, and the thing is because once if you've grown up in this era and you had not seen Dirty Dancing, there are four hit songs that you have no real context for.
Oh God, no!
Because they were huge hits when me and her were kids, and you know, they were everywhere. And if you hadn't seen Dirty Dancing, you didn't realize why they were everywhere.
That would be She's Like the Wind.
Yep.
Hungry Eyes.
Yep.
I've Had the Time of My Life.
Yep.
What's number four?
What is the fourth one? It wasn't as big a hit as the rest of them. It's
It was called Back Alley Doctor.
I don't know. What I do know is that this spawned a huge craze, much the same way Oh Brother, Where Art Thou did for folk music. But this spawned a huge craze for 50s and 60s tunes, and the soundtrack was wildly popular, and suddenly everybody was doing Latin dance moves on the 80s dance floor.
I do love the in the soundtrack, which is first rate, by the way, the combination of 60s top 40 and brand new 80s stuff, like, to the point that none of the characters in the movie are noticing when the music is of a completely different style. I fucking love that about this movie.
Except for the final dance scene, the difference is that one is diegetic and one is not. So the 80s stuff is not. That's literal over-the-top soundtrack stuff going on.
And it's very weird that it just keeps, like, it's a movie so immersed in its era and its soundtrack, and then it just veers off and
but I
gets
think that's
distracting.
What it works surprisingly well because it doesn't date the movie, because they do a really good job with the costumes, the makeup, everything else. Like, you watch it now and it is not horribly like, oh, look at your 60s hairstyles that are really 80s. No, they did a really good job of placing it in the proper time and place, but it's got this weird 80s laid over it, but it doesn't date it too horribly.
I will say this, much as Cargill's wife, I realized while watching this that I had never seen it start to finish.
What?
I know. But here's the great thing is I felt like I knew everything about this movie because even if you haven't seen it, it's been kept alive by weddings and flash mobs, because the end scene of this movie is so iconic that I guarantee you you've at least seen a YouTube video where some asshole at the wedding recreates the last scene. So for me, it was like, I feel like I know this movie. I know that there is. Here's what I knew going in. I knew that last scene, nobody puts baby in a corner, and abortion. Those are the three things I knew about this movie going in. And I didn't realize what a huge, like, I thought it was one of those things where, like, there's a story going on and then there's like a side story about somebody who gets in trouble. No, the driving force of this movie. The driving conflict of the movie, which is set in 1963, is about an abortion, which is fucking crazy.
I would go so far as to say one of the driving forces is women and gender roles.
This is true. This is true because, you know, we've talked a lot about how the 80s, and Cargill, I know you've spoken to this, they fetishized the 50s.
Yes.
That's a big thing about the 80s. This was one of the first movies I saw that while it kind of fetishizes the 50s, it also has a big, big problem with the conservatism of the 50s.
Yeah.
And is really speaking out against it.
Yeah. And interestingly, you know, we talked about the soundtrack and how it fetishizes. What I find interesting is that a lot of the songs that this incorporates are essentially the hipster tracks. They're essentially music from the late 50s and early 60s That were the B-sides, that were the really great
nobody
music.
Nobody knew any of these songs except for like maybe Soul Man, but like the
And
huge,
In the Still of the Night.
Like Cry to Me, which became the everybody's favorite song because that scene is hot and sexy. And then the one when they're crawling around.
Sylvia.
On the floor. Yes, that one. Nobody had ever heard of those songs and they were hard to get. So when the soundtrack came out, everybody was super excited because how else were you going to get those?
Also, Martin Scorsese, I'm going to let you finish. But Dirty Dancing beat you to like half your soundtracks from the 90s in 1987.
But to go back to how it's fetishizing the past, but then critiquing on it, Neil Kellerman, the son, nephew, I keep forgetting.
I think, son.
It's a throwaway line that it hit me when I rewatched it. He's like, oh, when the summer's over, me and some friends are going to go down to Mississippi and freedom ride. But the way he says it and then the way he treats people who are not in his class, it's like, oh, was the civil rights movement a fad to certain wealthy white people?
I mean, there's a great subplot.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously... But it's so subtle. What I love about this movie is that for as much as it is very broad in what it's talking about and in its emotional content, it is a subtle movie that does a lot of showing and no telling.
Yeah. There's actually a great sub-storyline in, I want to say it's the second or third season of Mad Men, that's all about that exact concept of, you know, this rich Madison Avenue guy is just dating a woman of color because it's fashionable, and he's going to Mississippi because it's fashionable, and everyone else in the office is calling him out for it.
Yeah, it's very much it was New York is a very liberal state, always has been. New York City, you know, is a very liberal city. So of course, you know, they don't actually say where everybody's from, but since they're out in the Catskills, it's assumed that these people are New Yorkers.
Well, and with Kellerman and Houseman, it's also unspoken that this is pretty much, it's a wealthy Jewish resort.
Yeah.
Because people do self-select, and so they're going to go with what they're most comfortable with.
By the way, the fourth song that I was mentioning is called Yes, which is the fourth.
Owner of a Lonely Heart. No?
I don't remember that song.
You know what? When you watched it, next time you watch the movie, you're like, oh shit, yeah, this song got airplay too. It's the least of the three, of the four songs that are new songs on the soundtrack, but they all got airplay because this movie was so huge. You could not get away from this movie in the summer of 87. Like, just, it was everywhere. It started a dance craze. It led to other movies trying to make dance craze movies happen. Like, this is the reason we got two Lumbada movies 2 years after this.
You know what? Much
Lumbada
as I love
and The Forbidden Dance.
Much as I love Golan and Globus, that shit hurts. Like, you guys, that one I can't. I have no excuse to make for you.
I saw both of those in theaters.
Well, and this movie, without this movie, we wouldn't have Hocus Pocus or High School Musical.
Oh, you laugh, dude.
I'm laughing because the people at home can't see the smile on your face, which was so proud.
Oh,
like,
dude,
you're just like, in theaters.
Not only do I know the names of both the Lumbada movies for the 3 weeks that the Lumbada craze existed, I actually attended both movies in the week they opened because, of course, I fucking did.
I feel like I should call you chief with all the feathers sprouting from your hat right now.
We're talking, this is me. I will watch every shitty dance movie ever made. My husband, when we go to the movies and there's some preview for a dance movie that's the worst thing, and he just looks at me with this long suffering, we're going to go see that, aren't we? Yes. I have never seen the Lumbada movies.
You know what?
They
here's good. And they're both terrible. They're not worth watching. You never cover them.
Why did you go see them?
Because, you know what? It's part of what I love about this movie. It's part of one of the things that the three of us love. We were talking about this over dinner yesterday. I love the whole concept of the sports movie. And most dance movies are actually built on the same structure as a sports movie. It is the same story. It is,
you could call it a competition movie.
A competition movie.
But don't call it a comeback.
Yeah. You've got antagonists in the way, and instead of fighting or, you know, sneaking around or doing any kind of crazy, you know, action movie stuff, you're actually going against them in this, whatever your competition is, and you go from villain to villain. You have to build up an ultimate villain that's, you know, your nemesis. You're working against that in some way, shape, or form. And that's what those movies are. You know, those movies are, but in like one of them, if I remember correctly, involves crime. Like some whole big drug plot. Like those movies aren't good. they're not worth remembering or dealing with. But so, you know, when there's nothing else opening, and really, that's the thing, is all the radio stations were playing the one Lambada song there was. The Lambada dance was being pushed. I ended up seeing the first one because I won tickets off the radio to see it, along with the soundtrack.
While listening to the Lambada song.
And, every time they played the Lambada song, I had this run of a year and a half in high school where if I ever tried to win a radio prize, I did. And so I would just try to win the craziest, stupidest things.
I'm sorry, Cargill, your application to the X-Men has been rejected. We don't think your superpower is that impressive.
It wasn't. In fact, it got to the point where I discovered that you can actually only win from every radio station once every 30 days. So I had to then alternate.
You gotta choose the right one to win, then.
I got really good at it. What are you going to do? I just became really good at winning prizes.
Hashtag for this episode, feathers in Cargill's cap.
Hey. Things that I won at the time, free Weird tickets to an Cargill early screening of Marked for Death.
Oh, sweet.
A Steven Seagal movie. I won a copy of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which is actually a pretty good fucking family movie. I just won all this stupid stuff. And it was pretty great. I got to go to a bunch of movie premieres. One time I won tickets to a movie and my mother decided she wasn't going to let me go see it and told the person that. And in response, when she went to pick it up, because she's like, oh, wait, no, I don't want my son seeing that movie without me. And it's on a school night. And so they were like, well, here, if you're not going to let him have the tickets, he should deserve a prize. Here's this album that's coming out this week. By this new band called Digital Underground, and he can have that.
Oh, God.
And so I won sex packets off the radio without actually winning sex packets.
Oh, my God. It's like a dark origin story.
Like, it's so I was really good at it. And so, yeah, I ended up winning tickets to see the Lombardo movie. And once I saw one, I'm like, well, now I got to see the other one.
Do you, though? Do you?
I didn't, but I did. So fuck you and fuck you. And I've seen the Lombada movies and you guys fucking have it.
By the way,
mic drop.
Okay, just going to back up the audio here a little
bit. Mic drop.
Fuck you. I've seen the Lombada movies is the weirdest hill to die on I have ever fucking seen. Fuck you. I've seen the Lombada movies.
You need something else to be proud of. We got to work on this for you.
While we're at the sidebar, take a few drinks because mentioning dance movies, we're covering every single one of the Step Up films at some point.
I fucking promise you that.
You know what? If we do, we have to do is one episode. I can't imagine.
Oh, I want to talk about the franchise.
Seven episodes.
The later they get, the more they just blend in.
You have never admitted this in public, but you love the Step Up movies.
I think I've admitted it. I think if you listen to this show enough, I've said it a few times. And I actually kind of feel that there is a weird alignment between the Fast and the Furious movies and the Step Up movies in that they get better as they go along.
Like if we're going to talk about dance movies at some point, we got to cover Strictly Ballroom. Somebody just got wet over there.
Lady boner for 200, Alex.
There is so much to unpack with the Strictly Ballroom movie.
And finally, we're definitely also covering Honey, I Shrunk the Kids because it's a fucking kids movie with a James Horner score written by Stuart Gordon, for fuck's sake.
It's pretty fucking great.
This time.
So let's get back to
the Catskills.
Can we talk about the cast?
Yes, we can.
We brought up Swayze, but I want to talk about Jerry Orbach.
Oh my God, so good in this movie.
This is easily his greatest performance. Like this is that role where like you see him and you're like, oh, that's the old cranky guy from Law and Order, and it's like, no, he's the fucking badass super dad from this fucking movie.
See, I had always heard that the parents in this movie were super conservative. So when I kept thinking about Jerry Orbach, it's what everybody kept saying, like it's the conservative parents from Dirty Dancing or like the uptight parents. So I was expecting him to be like the great Santini. And then when I saw this film, it turns out he's more like Atticus goddamn Finch.
Yes. I mean, he's a liberal. He's named his daughter after the first woman in the cabinet. He expects her to go into the Peace Corps. Like the way they talk about everybody who is in the upper class in this film feels really good about themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And their place in the world and what good people they are. And arguably, you could say that he and Margaret, his wife, are good people. Like, and they have raised two really good daughters. And baby comes up and says, somebody is in trouble and I need $250. That's a lot of money. And he just says, sure. Yeah, because that is my self-concept. I help people, and I'm in a position to help people. And of course, I would.
And my daughter is trusting me to trust her. And
yes, and that makes me feel really good. And that gets into the father-daughter dynamics, which are so wonderfully complex with the two daughters him. But Jerry Orbach, for me, with my background, I see him, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's Billy Flynn from the original cast of Chicago. This is a man who danced with Bob Fosse, Gwen Verdon, and Cheetah Rivera. Oh, and he was in the original cast of The Fantastics, which is the longest running show ever on Broadway. And so when you hear Try to Remember, do you know that song? That's Jerry Orbach singing it. Try to remember that time in September. So here's a man who...
That's Earth, Wind, and Fire, Wendy. Come on.
That's September.
Come on.
September, Dickweed.
Oh, I remember.
Oh, God, I'm going to... You're right next to me, and I just have to keep my hands off you so I don't actually kill you.
You know, all the guests have that problem, keeping their hands off me, especially Jason Murphy.
Yeah.
But
that's why I sit over here and recline.
Good call.
What I think is funny is in later life he got known for, you know, all of the crime TV shows. But at this point in his career, he was really trying to shake off the musical background, and so people would take him seriously as an actor, which is probably why he doesn't dance in this movie at all.
No.
He was, because he was trying to be taken, and it's kind of a crying shame because he was a great dancer. Jennifer Grey is the daughter of Joel Grey, who was in Cabaret.
Wow. So this is sort of a Broadway royalty like cast going on here.
Yes, very much so. And Cynthia Rhodes was in the Toto video, and she also was in Xanadu, Kenny Ortega, choreographed, but that's getting into the back. That's not cast, that's production staff. Who else is
it? And then, of course, Swayze was a, you know, as we've discussed ages ago, when, you know, the rare time we mentioned Skate Town USA, was was best known, you know, he had gotten his first acting role because he was a champion roller skate dancer. Like, he was, and he had moved away from roller skating and got into dancing after he was so successful in roller skating, but then they brought him in because they needed a good looking guy who could possibly act, who could roller skate, and he turned out to be fucking amazing and the biggest star to come out of that fucking movie.
Here's my question. I don't know if this is truth or a serpent eating its own tail in comedy. Was he actually a Chippendale dancer at one point in his life? Or was that just the SNL sketch?
No, that's the SNL sketch.
No, that's okay. Channing Tatum's background.
Oh, yeah, Charming
Tatum
Potato.
Was a Chippendale dancer.
Channing Tatum was a sexy.
But
sexy
much like Cargill's headdress with all the things he's weirdly proud of, the feathers on this guy's head, that hair on Swayze is remarkable. Just remarkable.
Nobody wore a mullet better than him. Like, so much so that we look back at the mullet and everybody laughs at mullets. No one ever laughs at a Swayze mullet. Like, Swayze's mullet always looks.
Put that on a goddamn t-shirt.
He had glorious hair.
Yeah.
Also, Cynthia Rhodes, how beautiful is that woman? They actually, when she's supposed to be sick in bed, they had to put so much makeup on her to make her not look pretty.
Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. She's like, I'm pregnant and I need to get it taken care of. It's like, sweetie, you haven't even had a meal today. Like, you are.
She's really skinny in this, which is like when you see her later, because she was also in Staying Alive. When you see her later, which is a few years later, or...
Like, Staying Alive would have been before this. Staying Alive was like 1980.
Yeah, so she must have lost weight. Like, it's weird because she's not that skinny in that. Yeah. Which, I mean, she was always a very tall and thin person. Oh, she's such a glorious dancer. Her legs go all the way up.
So for the few of you who are resisting watching this movie, because I did actually get some comments when I tweeted that we were going to be covering this movie. Some people were disappointed because they were like, well, that's more a movie for my wife. And I'm like, no. And I understand where the sentiment comes from. It's like, yes, we don't cover a lot of romantic films on this podcast, but
why is that, Brian?
I don't know. Apparently it's my fault. I didn't really, what's that, a bus? I actually, whenever there's something interesting about whether it's a romance film or a rom-com, I'm all about it. I like it when there are things that surprise me in any genre. And what I love about this particular movie and Swayze is that we were talking about how this movie is resisting a lot of the 50s conservatism. And yes, it takes place in 1963, but what is the 60s in American history, but a massive reaction to the Eisenhower, you know, white bread America of the 50s. Johnny Castle, the dance instructor slash possible gigolo of this resort.
Very definite gigolo.
I couldn't tell if that was like sanctioned by the hotel or just something.
Yes,
he
it
does.
Is.
Okay,
that's
cool.
It's sanctioned. Interesting. It's sanctioned for the wait staff, but he very clearly tells Johnny that you dance with them, you make them feel good, and then you back off and hands off because you're not a high enough quality. All the wait staff has been carefully culled from the best families and the best schools.
Those are for the daughters. The dance staff is for the frustrated wives.
Yes, but he doesn't want to know about it, and it's not sanctioned, but it's understood.
Yes.
So he is, in and of himself, and the fact that it's called Dirty Dancing and what's happening and what they're having to do in secret because the establishment couldn't possibly... It's fucking Elvis Presley. This whole movie is just a goddamn metaphor for what was going on in music when Elvis hit the scene, which was, oh my God, he's moving his pelvis. All of our daughters are going to get pregnant.
Yes. Yeah, and it is... It's really weird because this movie...
Prince the hair
itself,
on Swayze.
This movie presents itself as being very liberal, and yet at the same time, conceptually, it's uber conservative. Like it's a whole camp full of white people. There are literally, I think, two black cast members there who are dancers in the entire film, and yet there is still that huge culture divide of here are the rich people and there are all the poor people who live in the shitty shacks down the way.
The main conflict is a class conflict.
Yeah. It's snobs versus slobs, like all of our favorite 80s movies tend to be.
Yes. And it's expertly done. Like the whole misunderstanding it's one of those rare misunderstandings where you're not frustrated and going, why don't you just talk to each other? It's like, oh no, this is a legitimate misunderstanding that nobody gets that everyone else doesn't understand what's going on.
Well, and the number of ways that baby's eyes are opened by how she talks. Like, there's a great moment when she's talking to Penny. This is right before the evening where she finds Penny crying. And she goes up to her and she's seen her dance. She's seen her dance with Johnny and she's just wowed by her. She's like, you're amazing. You really were a rockette. And Penny responds, yeah, my mom kicked me out when I was 15. And I've been on my own ever since. And you've watched Penny looking at Robbie when you go back in retrospect, you know that Robbie has dumped her. She knows she's pregnant, right? There's all this going on in her life. And baby says to her, I envy you. And the look of pure disgust that Penny gives her, it's like, you privileged little snit. How dare you envy my life that has been a shit show from start to finish.
Yeah, and that's also one of the things that I love about this movie and in what I was talking about, how it's like a wish fulfillment movie for girls. It puts her in the position of being a mean girl to her the entire movie. And by the end, baby has earned her respect and her friendship. And the mean girl has become her closest friend.
But what I like is it never gets cheap like that. You don't get the 80s typical cheap mean girlness. She's looking at her like... It's so mature. This movie, for something that is, it's a dumb title and a ridiculous concept, and then you watch it
from
and
a distance, it looks very base.
And you think you're getting this cookie cutter shit, and instead it's tender and mature, intimate, sort of profound, and you take this character confronting their privilege. Like, I thought I was liberal. I thought I was going to go out and save the world. I thought I knew who my dad was. I thought I knew who I was. I thought I knew who my sister was. I'm a good person. I'm a good person. Oh, shit.
Yeah. And as it turns out, calling me baby is a great way to repress and infantilize me so I never have to confront anything that's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And yet what I love about her character is that there is never an ounce of judgment in anything that she should be. From where she's grown up, from the people she's been around, from the people she associates with, and you know, in the main camp, she should, by all rights, kind of be looking down her nose at these people. But at no point in this movie is there an ounce of judgment in her. When she finds out Penny's in trouble, the first thing she does is try to get money to help her,
and without a
second thought.
And that's where this movie becomes truly insane. And this is what I love about it, and why I think, God damn it, of course it's a junk food cinema movie. The entire plot of the movie is about a girl learning to dance so she can replace the girl who normally dances a show on a Thursday night so that she can go get an abortion. Like, the whole reason Baby learns to dance is to cover for someone so they can get an abortion. Like, this is how bug fuck nuts this movie is, and this became a mainstream fucking huge hit.
But what I love is the reason she ends up in that position, it's a great scene because she's like, well, can't somebody cover for you? And Swayze just lays into her with, no, because that person has to work, and she has to cover for Penny if Penny's going to go off to this. Everybody around here works.
Yeah.
And it's just so wonderful, and the disdain, and she's having to bump up against that. But to go back to you, Brian, you're right. She never says, she's so generous and truly sweet. She's one of the only people who says nice things to Lisa.
Yeah.
Like when they're at the dinner table and they're first getting introduced, and it's like, well, Baby's going to Holyoke and Baby's going to change the world. Dad is saying, Baby's going to change the world. Oh, and what about you, Lisa? And she, the way she says Lisa's going into decorating, she says it with sort of a quiet pride and in her daughter, in her sister, and my sister's pretty great. And it's kind of amazing because she's in a family dynamic where her dad is always discounting her older sister.
Oh, yeah.
And but Baby isn't. And then later on, when her sister becomes the favorite, she snipes at Baby.
Yeah, Dad actually listens to me now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's a bitterness there.
Yeah, and I want to go back to Orbach for a second because that's that genuineness and the sidestepping of cliche with him is you never have a moment where you're like, oh my, like. You always understand the decisions that he makes. And even when it runs counter to what we're trying to accomplish with Baby and with Johnny, there's never a moment where you're like, what a dick. You yeah. understand every motivation that he has throughout the entire movie.
And the way you can watch the wheels turning in his head when he realizes what's going on, when he's tipping the waiter and the waiter is like, oh, thanks for taking care of everything. I was...
Oh, that waiter. Oh, what a dick.
Oh, fuck
that
dick.
Dick. With his Fountainhead and Ayn Rand. And
Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, you should read this book. It's the Fountainhead. Oh, my God.
Because you know you should make friends with anyone who says that.
But that's the thing is that's part of what this movie's doing. Like, it's taking that subtle jab at the creation of the conservatives that in the 80s, in this era, we've talked about this repeatedly, about how we're seeing in 1986 and 87, we are seeing the rise of the Reagan Republican in terms of cinema. Like, we're seeing these famous Republicans go and take over as action heroes and make films that push this very kind of conservative agenda and sell it, you know, with, you know, as this great fast food awesomeness of America. And this is a movie that's very much needling that. And this is a movie that's going in the opposite direction of that.
In fact, Jerry Orbach, the dad, he has raised the daughter that he wanted. And in fact, the problems that he's got with her are she turned out exactly the way he wanted her to be. And she's turning around and going, you've raised me to believe these things. And now you're showing me that you don't really actually follow what you say.
Yeah.
You told me everybody is to be treated equal. And what you meant was everybody who looks like you.
And that's one of the really interesting things about the structure of this movie that I love is that this movie was sold and everyone remembers it as this great romance. And really the biggest conflict in this entire movie and what this movie's about from its opening line to its final summation, it's about the dad. Like one of the opening lines of the movie is, it was the summer of yada, yada, yada. At a time when I still thought my dad was the greatest guy in the world. And just as she says that, she hugs him from behind the seat and you just see them both glow. And it's like, this is a movie entirely about a daughter breaking away from her father and going off to be her own woman. And at the same time, the father wrapping his head around the fact that he needs to let this girl grow up to be a woman, which is why she's named Baby.
Yep.
Well, and she's not allowed. I mean, the way her femininity is suppressed throughout the film too, that's like, they call her Baby. She's the one in short. She's the one who's helpful. You can tell that she's been pushed to be the smart one. And therefore in this time period, you can't be smart and a girl. So we have to sublimate your femininity. And so when she starts encountering Johnny and the other staff, she's blown away just because here is a side of the world she's never gotten to see, which is this physical, emotional, expressive side. And when those doors open to that dance, it is just an onslaught of sensation of so much color and movement and sound. And the camera just goes rolling in and there's, well, you don't know what to look at first. It's all so exciting.
And in the competition film structure that's buried in here, because there isn't actually a competition, we have this great struggle of her trying to deal with that in a physical way that we can cheer on as an audience, which is the getting the lift. Like, she tries this whole movie to get the lift and have Johnny lift her. And it's because she always fails because she's not confident in herself. And finally, by the end of the movie, when all hell is broken loose and this great fucking dance number is going on and everybody's losing their shit, and it's a dance in the aisles of the movie theater scene, she finally nails that lift. And that's the moment where all of this thing that she's been, you know, fighting with this entire movie all kind of comes together. And you see the look on her father's face. And when he comes up to her at the end and he's like, "You look so great out there." It's just that, oh, I'm so happy right now. It's just a warm blanket of a finale. Well,
that's the first time he's looked at her and seen her as separate from himself.
And seen her as a woman.
Seen her as a person.
Not
seen
as a little girl.
Not just a woman, but seen her as a person, an independent person who's making her own choices as well. Because Baby is confronting who she truly wants to be. She's like, "Well, I want to save the world." Well, maybe I want to save the world in a different way than what I thought I did. Maybe I want to save the world. Maybe there's more out there than just this path that I thought, which was I'm going to go to college, I'm going to join the Peace Corps, and I'm going to marry a doctor like my dad and basically become my mother. And then Johnny is confronting, who do I want to be? And so it's about value, and how everybody treats everybody else is the value and their perceived value, their perceived worth. What he desperately wants is for her father to treat him with value. Yeah. And he can't even get the man to shake his hand.
Yeah.
And he goes to, and everybody in this movie is so fucking brave. The way Baby speaks up for him, the way Baby confronts her father, the way Baby asks Johnny to dance with her as a woman, not just in that time period, but when it came out in 1987, she's saying, "I would like to have sex with you," in so many words.
Oh yeah.
And that is a really brave, and especially given what their conversation has been, he hasn't overtly done anything to make clear that he'd be open to this, but she's like,
She pursues him.
And then Johnny is so brave when he goes to her father to try to fight for her. Nobody's ever done that for me, so I'm going to try doing something I've never done, and I'm going to go talk and try to explain to your father how wonderful I think you are, and the way her father shuts him down. I think that's why this movie was so powerful as a romance, but also to teenagers of all stripes, was it was really about finding your own identity and what it meant to be a good person, and that what you should look for in somebody that you wanted to give to be emotionally open to is somebody like these two people who are very brave and very vulnerable.
I love that scene with Orbach where Jennifer Grey's just laying it all out, and he isn't saying anything, but you can see him start to break down in his face. Like, it is one of the best pieces of acting because it's all just in his face.
Yeah.
He's not saying a word, but you can see the entire arc of what he's going through in his face.
And that's the stage actor in him.
Oh, 100%. Well,
you got to give mad props to the screenwriter and the director, because there are a lot of moments like that in this movie. Like, it's the morning after Baby and Johnny have had sex. They run into each other at Penny's cabin. It's all the awkward looks that everybody knows, those morning after looks of, "I don't know if we both want to admit that happened yet." And then she leaves. She waits for him. He comes out. It's awkward. He starts to walk away, and all she does is say, "Johnny." And he turns around, and they look at each other. And then he smiles, and then she smiles, and everything's okay. That's a really amazing bit of acting. Yeah. Because just that one word, Johnny, you could, a less confident director would have said, "I need you to have her say, you know, please," or "I hope I see you," or something. And instead it's just Johnny and all these questions left out there and then solved with a look. That's amazing.
And there's one thing I want to mention. This movie has one really weird moment.
Which one?
That really kind of, that doesn't play in, doesn't do anything. It's just there, and it's weird. When Johnny locks his keys in the car and then has to kick over a post and then breaks the back window, and it never comes up again. There's so many things they could have done with that, like, because money is such a big issue and getting a window fixed, and where are we going to get the window fixed or anything?
I think that moment was put in there to try to illustrate how physical he is, that he's somebody who solves problems physically, to how different he is from Baby, but also how frustrated and the pent-up aggression that the two of them have been having. And because right before that, for the first time, Baby comes back at him and gives him as good as he's giving her. She's like, yeah, you're right. I'm doing all this just to save your ass. And really what I want to do is just drop you on it. Fuck you. Suck a dick, man. And he's like,
in so many words.
And then he's like, and then he treats her as an equal in a way he hasn't been willing to before. He's like, you're right. Let's get out of here. Let us go together out of this place and to some place where, by its nature, the class constructs are going to be gone, because as long as they're in the resort, anybody walks in, that gets weird.
Well, but I think what is weird about it is her reaction, and I think she's directed this way, her reaction is of a sort of just completely smitten schoolgirl when he does that, like, oh my God, what a rebel. And I'm like, he's done way more rebellious things than break his own car window at this point. So I think that's where the weird element for me was, is I was like, she seems really into this, and all he did was break his own car window. I don't know that that's really what they were trying to accomplish.
Well, nobody in her class would ever break a car window. It has value. It has monetary value. You would have somebody fix that for you. That's not the way you solve problems.
Nobody breaks Baby's car window, that's for sure.
But you don't solve problems with brute force. So it's kind of exciting to have somebody who deals with a problem by just attacking it.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll attack me.
Maybe he'll rip someone's throat out. Speaking of Roadhouse.
Roadhouse?
Yes, because at watching this movie, there was a very romantic scene set to an Otis Redding song. And I'm like, I know this song. I know this tone. With Patrick Swayze. Oh, that's because he had a fucking love scene in Roadhouse to this same song.
Which is probably intentional.
Well, I looked it up. I was like, okay, maybe it just sounds like the same song. Nope, it's These Arms of Mine by Otis Redding, and it is on both movies' soundtracks. He's had the love scene to the same fucking Otis Redding song in two movies. I love Swayze. I love Swayze.
Who doesn't love Swayze?
That is one of the sexiest scenes ever filmed, as far as I'm concerned. I love the way that scene is filmed.
When he rips the guy's throat out, I know.
Yeah,
it is,
right? It's so hot.
I used to fuck guys like you in prison.
Song.
Yeah, right? Seriously? Gets me moist. No, I'm talking about the way that scene is shot, because it is shot with a female gaze. It is lingering over Swayze's body, his bicep, his shoulders,
everything about this movie. Swayze is the love interest, not the star.
Yeah,
like we talk about Swayze, but really everything about him, from the way he's written, like he could not be more a package of everything a woman wanted in 1987. Like, he's
manic pixie dream girl for the Elvis sex.
Exactly, because he's the greaser bad boy, but then the minute the door closes and you're alone, he is the sensitive guy who all he thinks about is, will people respect me, and I just kind of want to have a good life, and I want to be loved. Is that wrong? And like, and then out in front, he's like, nobody puts Baby in the corner.
You sounded like Harvey Fierstein there for a second. I just want to be loved. Is that so wrong?
I, you know, what are you gonna do? We were born with similar voices.
His hands.
That is so true, and I never put two and two together until just now. There's my second Otis Redding moment. Ugh, putting two and two together. Speaking of Harvey Fierstein in No Way, I'd always heard the term Catskills comedian. I'd always heard that was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
I never really knew what it was, and apparently the answer is it's Newman from Seinfeld.
Yes.
It's essentially, you would hire comedians to go out to these resorts, and they were the daily entertainment. Like, they were just literally around trying to entertain everybody and keep everybody laughing and be the life of the party. And it was where bad comedians went to die.
Well, and young comedians learned the ropes and the history and the tradition.
I think he's playing a character called This Fucking Guy again. Because I could imagine if I was actually at this resort and every activity he's just floating around making and I know this is hypocritical coming from me, floating around making terrible jokes all the time.
That is a bit the pot calling the kettle a pot.
it's true. It's very true. But maybe because it was Wayne Knight. I don't know. Maybe I just irrationally hate that guy's
something
face.
Something else I noticed when Johnny comes walking in the first when he comes walking in on the scene with the waiters and he's got the rest of the entertainment staff with him, and Kellerman even says, "You entertainment staffers." Every male behind him is brown, is like Hispanic or really dark or Italian, like very definitively a different class of people, especially when compared to how white and waspy all the waiters are.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, I read this, all of the rehearsals for this movie. Turned into drunken dance parties.
Which is the way we like it.
Because that is, by the way, I'm here to tell you as a theater person, that scene with the watermelon, that is pretty much what happens to any group of entertainers off after hours. They totally go and do shit like that. It's not hyperbole. They don't dance that well necessarily.
I carried a watermelon.
Yeah, I know. She's so great.
It was such
She's
a great
so
nerdy
great
moment.
And awkward.
Yeah, no, Jennifer Grey. Talked enough about how great she is.
I thought it was like a dog whistle thing. It was like, am I supposed to get that? Is that something that, am I just not the right group to, what do you mean you carried a watermelon? Oh, you literally mean you carried a watermelon. Okay,
I carried a watermelon. It is the classic line of, I'm awkward. And so people quote it now just to be like, I'd like to acknowledge how awkward I am. I carried a watermelon.
By the way,
but she is so great in this.
She really is.
She's smart and competent. She's powerful. She goes after what she wants. What I love about it is, like, when I was a teenager watching this, here's a movie where the smart girl who's not the prettiest girl in the room gets arguably the hottest guy in the room, and the way he looks at her, he physically desires her. That's why that crawling on the floor scene is so sexy, because he can't keep his hands off her.
The chemistry between them is fucking palpable.
Which is really interesting when you delve into the story behind the making of this movie, because they'd worked together before in Red Dawn and fucking hated each other. Like, they did not get along on that set at all. And then when they started this movie, they had kind of put that behind them. They were starting to work well. But then during the movie, they started to hate each other again. And there are also all of these little moments where, because this director, Emil Ardolino, was very much in favor of just turn the camera on and let it roll for a while and we'll improvise some things. So some of the most famous bits of this movie, including the hey baby, like in the crawling toward each other, completely improvised.
Well, it's not so much improvised. That's them fucking around between takes. Trying to get in the mood, them limbering up the way dancers will, the way people who have to move will, like, okay, you're going to do this, I'm going to do this. And then you're going to do this and I'm going to do this. And in the process of marking through it, you goof around a little bit like, hey, dumbass. Oh, no, you're the dumbass. So that's a smart director, because true performers, that's the way. And then you get something more natural, like the more a stage performer can get a run at something, every time they do it, it gets looser, it gets more natural. They find a different beat, they'll try a different take. I love to watch stage actors in a film because the way they approach the work is completely different than a film actor, obviously. And so then the scene where he keeps running his fingers down her arm and she keeps giggling, that was all real. It was the end of the day. She was exhausted and it was truly tickling her. And his look of frustration is real. He's like, I just want to get this fucking take so we can go home. And she keeps giggling. My God, you're driving me nuts. And they're like, no, this perfectly encapsulates what should be happening between these two characters in this moment.
Now I'm curious, how did it end? Did they finally get their shit together and like each other, or did they fucking hate each other?
Actually, the director was getting frustrated because it got to the point where the two of them were arguing before every take, but their screen test had been so great. He sat them down and made them rewatch their screen test to go, look at how good you guys are together. And it worked. They came back and were like, you're right, that's what we want. And because both of them, ultimately, they need this movie. Jennifer Grey was young and hungry. That when they did the lake scene, it was fucking October. That lake was so cold. They don't have close-ups during that scene because their lips were actually blue and they were chattering. So she's like, if I now, I would have said no to going into that lake, but I was young and hungry. I needed that movie.
Yeah, the filming was delayed by bad weather, so they had to film that scene in the autumn, so it was fucking cold. But then in like reverse John Carpenter style, they're like, oh wait, all of the trees are turning colors. Spray paint them, spray paint all the trees green, which is pretty much the exact opposite of Carpenter having to bring in colored leaves to LA in the summer to make it look like fall. It's like the complete reverse of that. But I just imagine there's a guy on set whose job it is that day, like, oh, I've got the sheet here, it looks like from 3 to 5 I'll be spray painting trees. Okay, this is what I got into the industry for. Clearly I've made it.
I want to spray paint trees when I grow up.
As does everyone who's young and hungry.
But I love the reason Johnny is such a great romantic character, but an idealized one, is he looks like this big tough guy, and then he keeps surprising you and with how tender he can be. And it's the tenderness that is surprising, because a lot of the teen movies at this time, a lot of the romantic movies at this time, like you go to Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the John Hughes ones, there's not any real intimacy that comes up. Not in this way. And so every time that he opens up, like that, as a teenage girl, I'm watching going, oh, is that a thing that can happen? Oh, what would that be like?
Yeah.
Oh, to have somebody who wants my father's respect? That would be cool. But can I start talking about Kenny Ortega now?
Yeah, no, we told you specifically not until the 45-minute mark. God damn it, Wendy.
Yeah, I'm gonna get off of how great Swayze is and talk about Kenny Ortega. For as much as this is a dance movie, it's not really as strongly a dance movie as you remember. But
it's also not a competition movie, as we mentioned, and yet there's a stellar fucking montage.
Yes, there's the underlying structure of it being there with the driving force of it just being, we need this performance to go off. And then, of course, there's the big talent show at the end of the year.
Like, let's remember that there was actually a touring show of Dirty Dancing, where all of these couples who were in this movie were actually touring and performing live that people paid money to go see after this movie.
Yeah.
Doriana Sanchez, who's one of the dancers, is now a very well-known choreographer and works on So You Think You Can Dance. Kenny Ortega was a protege of Gene Kelly, thanks to Xanadu.
Oh, and this is why you're going nuts. You are like literally the biggest Gene Kelly fan.
Oh my God. I just realized you Kaiser Soze'd your way onto this episode of the podcast. I'm like, she seems really adamant to be on the Dirty Dancing episode. Oh, because it's a secret Gene Kelly movie. Oh, I get it now.
Well, Gene Kelly taught him how to stage for the film, for the camera. And then it was actually, was it on Xanadu? What was the other one he did? But he did second unit directing. Oh, on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Hughes had him second unit direct on Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that's where he learned more about staging and filming and how to set up a shot. And so he's getting this great 1-2 punch in filmography that we get to take advantage of here, because what I love is you get to see all the best parts of the dancing from all the best angles. These dance numbers are shot so well. Like I said, when you go into that first staff dance, the way the camera is going around all those dancers, it is exciting, but it is never frenetic. And that's sort of amazing. And so he went on to create this entire dance craze. And it's all because when he was at a bar, the Tubes were at that bar, saw him on the dance floor, and said, we like the way you move. Would you, we're going on a national tour and we've realized we need a choreographer to do the things that we don't know how to do. Would you like to do that? And then for 10 years, he basically became like the 8th member of the Tubes.
And like that, he dances.
Well, because he'd been a hoofer. Like, he was in a touring company of Hair. He was going to take a role in Jesus Christ Superstar, and then he got derailed into the Tubes. The Tubes loved him, and then Cher. And then so for a while out in L.A., he was the guy who did your touring dance shows, which then I'm curious to know whether he got the Tubes onto Xanadu, or Xanadu got him onto, or the Tubes got him onto Xanadu, like how that worked.
It's like the chicken or the new wave egg. Like, you can't really, it's a forever conundrum. But what I find interesting about the choreography here is that not only do you have to choreograph all of these amazing numbers of, you know, the wait staff just like all over each other, and the thrusting and the like really like sexualized and passionate dancing. You also have to choreograph a bunch of lame rich people doing foxtrots to create the juxtaposition of why the staff dancing is so controversial. Because I can imagine someone young watching this movie now and going, I thought the dancing would be a lot dirtier. I mean, I've been to a club where it's a lot filthier than this on a Tuesday. So I like that they actually go through the trouble of not only...
Yeah, in the era of twerking, it's hard to be offended by dirty dancing.
This was, and I will say this, bear in mind that my experience is white, duh. The 80s were a huge hip hop, that's the birth of hip hop. I don't know what was going on in hip hop clubs, right? Because I was in your more classic Janet Jackson, Michael Jackson. When I went to clubs and we were dancing, that's what we were dancing to, and we were dancing that kind of style of dance. So this was actually a little bit of a revelation of, oh, this is a different way to dance that nobody has been doing. I don't know what was going on in different cultural dances, because like now on the dance floor, the hip hop, like a lot of where that comes from, you say twerk, well, obviously twerking is coming from the hip hop dance scene. But no, this was incredibly like, you're going to do that right where people can see you? And then kids were starting to actually do this on the dance floor. And there was a lot of dirty dance shaming happening of, oh my God, did you see Becky? She was totally dirty dancing with Kevin Saturday night.
No, wait, is she the one with the big butt?
Yes, she is, okay. Actually.
I just wanted to make sure.
Oh my God, Becky.
That was really something
so
that happened.
Big.
Well, and Jennifer Grey's dance performance is so great because you see her do the exact same dance twice. And the first time she does it, she is so stiff.
Yeah.
Her neck, her shoulders, her hips, everything. And it's so delightful then to see her dance it again and see her dance it freely at the end and go, oh, look at how great. That's not easy to do. It's not easy to learn a dance and perform it in two different styles.
Yeah. And I mean, and this movie really is about acceptance, about trying to get people to see you for who you are. In Baby's case, like, I'm not a child. And in Johnny's case, I am not scum just because I don't have as much money as you, which is why the rapid succession at the end, and oh, believe me, we're going to talk about that final scene in just a second, but the rapid succession at the end of nobody puts Baby in a corner, which is one of the most famous movie lines ever spoken, instantly, like, no, this is a person who couldn't dance to save her life a few days ago, but now is so good at this that she should be out there on the floor and everyone should see her. She should be recognized for being as talented as she is and as much a woman as she is. And then immediately thereafter, when Jerry Orbach comes up to Johnny and says, I found out it wasn't you who got that girl in trouble. And, you know, when I'm wrong, I say I'm wrong. And I just love that moment, because that's really all Johnny ever wanted to hear anybody say was, I was wrong about you. And it's such, like, I can freely admit, like, I got a little teary at the end of this movie.
A little misty.
I'm not afraid to say it.
It's a beautiful moment. Speaking of value, like, there is something, if you really, again, so much is unsaid, you have to stop and think about it. Why was Penny with Robbie? Robbie's a higher class than her. Robbie was paying attention to her. Suddenly somebody who has a higher social standing is paying attention to her. I really thought he loved me. And that, like, what does that say about what Penny would like to have happen to her? Like, that I could be valued by a man of quality. When she talks about her father, he's such a nice man. He's amazing. He's wonderful. And he's treating me like a real lady. He's treating me, even though he's helping me after an abortion, it's clear that he's not shaming her, because she glows when she talks about him. So she is meeting an exemplar of the breed. So that's what she would like. But when there's that great moment when they're getting Baby dressed and Baby is so scared about dancing. And then she says, thanks, Baby. And then she says, I'm scared. And you go, oh shit, Baby's scared she's going to screw up the steps. And Penny is standing right next to her going, I'm going to have a strange man cut me open with a knife tonight.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so amazing that Jerry Orbach, when that goes wrong, there's not even like, he gets pissed at everybody involved later. But at that moment, it's like, I'm a doctor and I'm going to save this girl. And he has the best bedside manner with her. And you're blown away by how caring he is throughout that whole process. And
do you think he's given abortions before?
That,
interesting.
I don't know.
There were legal procedures that they would call that would do the same thing. You'd get a C&D.
Dun, dun.
It was a C&D that you could go have your doctor do that conveniently would get rid of any tissue that might be in your uterus at the time. And if you were wealthy, you could afford to have it done because, by the way, if you were wealthy, nothing is ever actually illegal. You just have to call it something else and pay a little bit more money.
See, this is why I don't understand why Law and Order Catskills didn't stick around as long as it should have. That's all I'm
saying. Dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun, dun.
Well, and it's another throwaway thing. When she says, well, can't you just miss the performance? If they miss even one night of dancing at that other hotel, they lose their whole season's salary.
Yeah.
They are wage slaves.
Yeah. They're indentured servants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like when that gets brought up, and then Johnny makes it clear he's willing to give her every dime. And then she looks at him and says, and it doesn't matter, it still wouldn't be enough. Like, Johnny has saved up so much money, and it's not even $250.
Yeah.
Like, what does that say about what they're living? And he's like, I can't do anything to jeopardize this. I need this gig lined up for next year. Like, it looks so fun and it's such a beautiful environment, but realistically, they're being told what to do with every minute of the day. Penny, when she's not dancing, has to be doing the wig activity. She has to be teaching the classes. She's got to be doing this. It's like working on a cruise ship. I don't know if you know what that's like. I've never had to do it. But when you get hired as an entertainer on a cruise ship, that is a full-time position, even though you only dance in the show at night.
Why has there never been a sitcom about that? Why has there never been a sitcom about people who are hired to be entertainers on a cruise ship that are just stuck on that goddamn boat?
Because there was a really super popular show for like a decade about that.
Gilligan's Island, yeah.
Yeah.
McMillan and Wife. What are we talking?
Love Boat.
Oh, no, that, yeah, no.
Promising something for everyone. No, it was the positive version of that show, but you weren't going to ever sell a sitcom based on, we want to do the Love Boat, but it really sucks. Like, that's the, you know...
Enter Brian.
Where I think now you could totally do that. Although, you know, sitcoms are not really, you know, as popular anymore.
It's The Office on a cruise ship.
But yeah, I mean, Love Boat was so ubiquitous in this era. Like, when sitcoms were the thing, people would be like, oh, so it's The Love Boat, except that these people... And you know, the reason why The Love Boat worked was because it was it was partnered with Princess Cruise Lines. Mm. And so they, you know, they were selling cruises to people every week. So they were paying quite a bit of money in support of this show for all of this advertising that was going out every fucking week.
And it was so ubiquitous that it literally soon it would be making another round because you couldn't get rid of that goddamn show in syndication.
Yeah. That ship, by the way, God, what was the name of the ship on the Love
the
Boat?
The SS Minnow.
No.
Damn it.
Keep making this joke, but it had a name, and it actually, when you would go to a travel agent, the booklet, the first page would be where that ship was touring for the different seasons.
The Jupiter 2.
So that you could actually ride on the Love Boat, like
Surfside
the official
6.
Love Boat.
It wouldn't matter if it didn't have Gopher and Gavin McLeod. What's the point, man?
Julie, man. It was all about Julie. Julie knew how to program fucking activities.
Right? She did. Do you remember when that other person came onto the show?
It wasn't the same.
And hey, it wasn't the same.
We're right back
was
at
all like having a crisis of confidence. Man, that was a tough episode.
We're right back at the sidebar. So, Isaac, get me another one.
Stargrove.
Yeah, we got to talk about the other two massive stars of this movie, who are, of course, Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnes, because that song is, speaking of ubiquitous, it is 30 years later as inescapable as it was the day this
now
movie came out.
Had the time of my life.
God.
Never felt like this before.
Turn it off. Stop it.
Cargill and Brian have microphones and they're singing.
Yeah.
This can only go in terrible directions.
You know why? Because we weren't sanctioned and nobody can stop us.
Nobody can stop us.
Stop it!
Nothing's going to stop us now.
Oh, that's a different movie we'll talk about. also from 87, just a heads up. yes.
Okay, so something I want to point out I find interesting about the love scene and about how these two romantic characters interact. First off, in the sex scene, in the seduction scene, they don't kiss until the end.
No.
They don't kiss until, like, it's clear they finished the act. Like, that's not...
Maybe it's a Pretty Woman situation where, like, they don't kiss on the mouth.
It's interesting because if you count when and how many times they kiss...
Which I think you've done, I would imagine.
I probably did. Yeah. They very rarely kiss. Like, And when it's often very short of like the true romantic kiss that you would expect to start their relationship, you actually get as the final moment in the movie. But they never, ever say, I love you.
Well, they kiss with their hips. They kiss with their that's bathing not what
that's
suit
called.
Regions.
That's not what that's called.
Is that not what it's called?
That's what I kiss. but I kind of love it because what are the odds this relationship is going to work? I think what I kind of, the reason I like this movie is there's a reality and a weight to it that every other movie, like, oh, they end up together at the end, like Pretty in Pink or, you know, whatever. And this one is like, well, they're together at the end, but she's going off to college in the fall. And what are the odds this relationship is ever going to...
It's a summer camp relationship.
Yeah.
It's her summer camp boyfriend.
But it's unusual that it would be that honest about this isn't forever love. This is just...
Yeah, and just like my summer camp experience, there was an abortion. Like, it was crazy. It was horrifying, but that's the way camp is for most people.
Because you were with a dude, and
right?
It was just... It didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any sense whatsoever, but then again...
Like this line of jokes.
But do you know, that was... That was and is powerful. Sorry to be the serious one here, dudes. That was and is powerful because women in the 60s, women in the 80s were still expected that they would find somebody to love and that would be their defining characteristic. And instead, she's found somebody who loves her for who she truly is, who has forced her to be a better person. But you get the very, it is very strongly hinted, this isn't her forever person. That's kind of amazing.
Because she's like the wind. She's out of his league. She's gone.
He's also nailed half a dozen other women at the camp that week that she's there.
Yeah, for sure.
They're there 3 weeks. So that would be 18 women if it's half a dozen per week. I can do math.
The sex math you're doing on this movie is incredible. Like, Stephen Hawking has to be like, well, that's weird.
Well, you know what? When you're motivated, you're motivated.
I guess so. But no, getting back to that song for a second, and not I've Had the Time of My Life, but She's Like the Wind. I actually find it very funny that that song was not written for Dirty Dancing. It was written for a film that Cargill has actually been telling me for a while we need to cover on the show. It's a little movie called Grandview, USA.
Oh, yeah.
Which do you know what you know of this movie?
Well,
of this film?
I have not seen it, but Cargill has spoken to me about it often. It's written for Grandview, USA.
It was written for Grandview, USA.
That's another Swayze flick.
It is another Swayze flick.
Not Skate Town, USA. Although maybe Skate Town, USA is a suburb
do you
of
think,
Grandview,
okay, so
USA.
Maybe
is Skate Town, USA in Grandview, USA?
I think Skate Town is like the voting district, but Grandview is like the principality, or maybe that's Canada.
Well,
I don't know how that works.
Honestly, the way we name our skating rinks is often something like Skate Town. So maybe Skate Town USA is literally
just
the skating rink in Grandview, USA.
Interesting. So the skating rink was not its own municipal district. It was literally just the name of the skating rink.
It might have been a county.
Okay.
Congressional district.
Yeah.
Because I would vote.
Skate Town abuts Grandview.
I would vote for Patrick Swayze's hips to be my congressional representative. I feel like they would vote for my interests.
He would soundly defeat that asshole Scott Baio. That's all.
So you weren't there that night we watched Grandview, USA?
No.
Oh, you missed the Grandview. Yeah, we're going to talk about this eventually because, I mean, it's, first of all, as we've said, we're Swayze crazy. We will probably cover almost everything Swayze's ever been in at some point.
Swayze great!
And this is the one where he plays a redneck demolition derby driver. Who has this long time pining for with Jamie Lee Curtis, and then we've also thrown in another 80s actor in there with C. Thomas Howell, who's the young kid who really just wants to raise money so he can go up and go swimming because he wants to become a marine biologist because he loves scuba diving, and it's a weird fucking movie, but it's actually really good and very 80s. And so, yeah, we'll talk about that eventually. But I didn't know that was written for Grandview, USA.
We have to talk about that movie because Swayze plays a character named Ernie Slam Webster.
Yeah.
So here's what I imagine is going to happen is that at some point there will be a great triple feature of the two Patrick Swayze redneck movies, which are, of course, Grandview, USA and Next of Kin. And then immediately follow that with... Soderbergh's what's the one that is just coming out where even Daniel Craig plays a redneck?
Logan Lucky.
Logan Lucky. Like, it's going to be the most amazing
triple
feature.
Peeking.
I'm naked.
I heard you boys were dumb. No, everybody said you were dumb. They say that about us.
I'm very excited about Logan Lucky.
I also want to mention the fact that another Junk Food alum, Mr. Billy Zane, was up for the lead role.
He was up for Johnny?
He was up for Johnny. He and Sarah Jessica Parker auditioned for the leads together.
You know what? The problem is when I think about Sarah Jessica Parker, something this movie goes, girls just want to have fun. And that gets weird in my head.
Yeah, it does.
Because this is a Mary Poppins movie. Like, this is a movie that is a serious drama trying to talk to you about what it means to be a good person. And they just dress it up with sexy pelvises to get you to watch it.
Well, the original title, the working title, was Sexy Pelvises. And they were like, that's a little too on the nose. Just call it Dirty Dancing.
It's just still a dumb title. I remember when this came out, I'm like, Dirty Dancing? What a dumbass title for a movie. I don't know if I want to see that. And then it became wildly popular. I'm like,
How many times did you see this in a theater when it came out?
Wait. Let's do Price is Right. This is Price is Right. My guess is going to be 5 times.
Shit. Then that's pretty close, I'm guessing. So I'll go 6 so that I cut you off.
All right.
I never saw it in theaters.
Oh, we should have went with a dollar, Bob.
You should have. Yeah.
Fuck. You skipped it in theaters.
It wasn't that I skipped it. Let's remember my upbringing wasn't always the best. And it was one of those where I didn't get out to it. And I was also one of those kids who was involved in theater and all the other things. So I wasn't actually home a whole lot to go see films. If it didn't show up at the Dollar Theater that was 6 blocks away, I probably didn't see it. And this one hadn't, it never got there, weirdly.
Why is that song, going back to I've Had the Time of My Life, why is it so good? Why is it still
I would argue it's
so
the underlying
good.
Latin beat.
That's very possible. Is it an association with the movie, or does it, this is the thing that I've always been fascinated by. Would that song stand on its own were it not from the climax of this movie?
Well, it does what a lot of good climactic dance songs do. First off, it has a slow start, and then that beat kicks in right there. It's more exciting. Yeah, doom doom ka doom ka doom ka doom, and then that starts driving, and that beat is a driving beat. It's one that pushes you forward, mm-hmm. and then it just builds, and then it explodes. Like, it's actually kind of a very hackneyed song in structure, but it's such a perfect example of that type of song that you're. It's one of those songs where you're like, oh, this fucking song. Well, I can't help it. I guess I got to dance. So there are just some songs you're like, well, I dare you not to dance to this song. You're going to dance to this song.
Also, that fucking bass in his voice.
Oh my God.
Like, the way that comes in, you know, just the way that opens that song up, it's just great. Just it's one of those things where it's a bunch of very slight things all put together that work magically and create this one soup. Because that was pretty much it for them, right? That was the one hit one.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, if you go out and buy the greatest hits of Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnes, it's going to be a 45. Like, there ain't going to be much else on there.
Bill Medley is the Righteous Brothers. We know that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the two of them together, that's
why. Yeah, okay, just check it in.
Hence
like,
why I said, if you go out and buy the greatest hits of Medley and Warnes.
But that's why that voice is so great. It's the fucking Righteous Brothers. And like, he starts growling out at you. You're like, I'm getting weak in all my girly bits.
It does sound like Barry White's cock halfway down Tom Waits' throat. It is that much bass. What?
Whoa, there's a lot of bass in that.
Wow. There is a lot. That's a lot of bass. It's a pornographic amount of bass. This is the point.
That's vivid, Brian.
This is my concern, dude.
You drew a picture with words there.
This is why my son will never be able to go back and listen to this podcast once he's old enough to know what the internet is. I'm going to burn all of this down.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
That brings us to the junk food pairing. And
before we do the junk food pairing, I want to address something we were going to do earlier. We have not been able to do this yet. We pulled a boner.
Oh, shit, we did?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago when we did The Lost Boys, we kept referring to Bernard Herrmann instead of Edward Herrmann.
I'm going to stop you. You did that. I listened to that episode. You for most of the episode referred to him as Edward Herrmann. There was like one point where you said Bernard Herrmann, because I remember when I was editing it, I was like, oh, he said Bernard Herrmann. I'm going to leave it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you bastard.
Well, what else was I going to do? Like, I know. Otherwise, it'd be this. This is what it would sound like. Oh, yeah. Bernard Herrmann. Like, it would just like be so clear that I edited it.
Edward.
And people would be like, what did he... Did he say fuck nuts Herrmann? What happened? What is with the edit?
Yeah, so anyhow, I pulled a boner, and I wanted to acknowledge that I know several of you chuckled at it, and yes, I pulled a boner, and I apologize.
As it turns out, the great composer and Hitchcock collaborator, Bernard Herrmann, was not the head vampire in Lost Boys, although what an amazing movie.
What did you say?
I know, right? Hey, but here's a connection. Edward Herman played Rory Gilmore's father. Rory Gilmore? Yes.
Yeah,
no,
on
no.
the Gilmore Girls.
Yes, on the Gilmore Girls. The mother was played by Emily Bishop, who's in this movie as baby's mom. So there's your weird...
Who was only 12 years older than the two girls who were supposed to be her daughter. I forget who was supposed to be the mom, but she had to back out. And so it caused this weird casting ripple. The mom was supposed to be the Bungalow Bunny sex kitten. That's the role she was originally cast as. And then that, when they lost the mom, she moved into the mom role, and then the assistant choreographer moved into that role.
And yet, so the Bungalow Bunny actually had more lines.
You're not wrong. But let's picture for a second, baby's mom, so sweet, so wholesome, so wonderful. Let her dance, darling. And smacking and whacking all up on Patrick Swayze.
That would satisfy a very specific fetish I had while watching the Gilmore Girls. Just going to throw that out there. I'm also checking to see if the domain bungalowbunnies.com is available. Yes, it is. Get ready for that website.
All right. So, the junk food pairing.
The junk food pairing. We wanted to go with something that was really... like from this era, that would be a summer treat that you would get in 1963 and sort of the tail end of the 50s, and something that was wholesome and representative of the era. So we went with, of course, a milkshake.
With two straws.
With two straws. It doesn't matter if it's a malt, if it's a milkshake, if it's an egg cream. Drop two straws in that bitch, because then it's traditionally 50s and you can't say things like, drop straws in that bitch. But yeah, shake it up, baby. That is going to be our junk food pairing for this week.
What, not a cherry pie?
Could also go with a cherry pie. Yeah.
Fork to pull those cherries. I'm sorry.
Oh my God. See, okay. No. Everyone heard that, right? Precedent has been set. So now I can make the joke that I didn't make because I thought it was too horrible.
Oh, Christ.
When you said this was like Mary Poppins, Christ. I just imagined people pulling things out of her, like that carpet bag in Mary Poppins.
Steak tartare.
What is Mary having there? Some little fetuses that she's pulling.
Aren't you glad we didn't make any of those jokes on the air? Because that would be horrible.
I don't know if this should survive.
I'm just saying, precedent was set.
Cut.
Don't say that about this particular scene in the movie, okay?
Whoa.
If you would like to, Wendy, if people would like to find you online, would you like to tell them where they can find you should you wish to be found?
At Wendelina on Twitter, when I do tweet. No, you can't have my Facebook account. I post too many pictures of me drunk on there, so no. And occasionally I do podcasts. I'm working on a new podcast, going to be Real Education Musicals, so nice. When that comes out.
Yeah, Wendy's saying there's too many pictures of me drunk on my Facebook is like saying there's too many paintings in the Louvre. there's a plethora. And as for us, just remember, we're on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We're on Patreon, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. If you'd like to support us and help us keep making these awful, awful jokes that I have to apologize for.
The thing that hurts me the most is I know that you've been planning that since before we started recording.
No, it really wasn't until she said Mary Poppins. And if there was a video of us...
No, then just remember.
Oh, yeah, no, that was. Yeah.
You've had that plan, and it's like, oh, God.
I just wanted to say that I've had the time of my life.
Oh, fuck all of you.
Is that the truth?
Oh.
It's the truth.
Okay.
And I owe it all to you.
Sorry. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
At She Leads Me Through Moonlight Only to Burn Me With The Sun.com.
Which, by the way, could be the tagline of having Wendy on this show.
Oh, my God. What have we done?
Also the tagline of having Wendy on this show.
At Massaworm. That's MASSAWIRM on both Twitter and Instagram.
Awesome.
Oh, you Instagram? You do Instagram now. Aw, shit, y'all.
He's a white guy on Instagram. He's now a graham cracker. What up? What up? Thank
Wait
you.
There.
I hate you both so much. Next week, we'll be covering both Lombada movies.
Next,
fuck Brian, that's why.
And next week, you can call it the Forbidden Dance. It should be the Forbidden Movie.
Yeah,
the
true story. Come back next week for the very last episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on Film School Rejects and Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for whatever. Go, just nobody puts baby in a corner, and nobody should listen to this podcast. Can't look in her eyes. She's out of my league. Just a fool to believe I have anything she needs. She's like the wind.